The Murthy law firm has been clarifying US immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. We are happy to offer this free service. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Welcome to the Murthy Podcast. I'm Kevin Andrews. Today I'm joined with Maggie Wagner, and we are going to be talking about perm audits. With the election over and the new administration coming in the next month or so, I think we're anticipating an increased enforcement, compliance type of environment. And one of the areas that is mostly affected is the area of labor certification and compliance and perm audit. So Maggie, what exactly is a perm audit?
Yeah, thanks. So perm audits do occur after the perm labor certification is actually filed. And it's where the U.S. Department of Labor reviews the case to ensure that the employer is complying with all the applicable legal requirements surrounding the perm labor certification. And these audits can be triggered by specific concerns, or they can be done randomly. So, you know, it's important for everybody to be aware that perm audits can happen and make sure you have everything in place for that.
Well, that's concerning because basically you're saying that it will be up to the government to decide whether to increase or decrease the rate of audits. They don't seem to be happening too frequently now, but the processing of a regular perm, you know, is taking like over a year. So with audits, I mean, we can expect longer processing times, right?
It's possible.
Yeah, so I could see how that by itself, just the sheer fact that the audit will just, you know, drag out the processing times is going to be a major obstacle for a lot of people. So, policy-wise, why is Department of Labor conducting perm audits to begin? I mean, you know, they can toggle up and down how frequently they do it, but what is the policy purpose behind doing them?
Right, so DOL conducts these perm audits to verify that the petitioning employer, like I said, has really met those legal requirements surrounding the perm, and that's for recruiting and screening non-immigrant workers. So since the perm process is attestation-based, employers certify that they have followed the steps, but they don't really submit any proof up front. So these audits help DOL ensure compliance by actually asking for that proof. Then the employer has to show that they have complied and not just, you know, signing something and saying that you have complied.
Right. So like in the perm application, in the recruitment section, for example, it says give the dates where you place the ads, but you could just say whatever you want in there. You need to actually place the ads, but you don't have to actually submit that as proof unless, you know, it's asked for, I guess, and it would be like in the form of an audit where that kind of stuff could be asked for, right?
Right, exactly.
Is there like a standard type of perm or what does a DOL audit typically entail, and what kind of things do they ask for?
So in a standard audit, the DOL will request a copy of the perm application, and that's signed by the employer and the employee. And then if you had an attorney, it will also be signed by the attorney. And then usually they'll also request all advertisement documentation, the mandatory notice of filing, the recruitment report, and the prevailing wage determination. And then specific case-related documents can also be requested, you know, on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, I think, for example, an example I've seen there is if DOL has questions about whether the company is really engaged in some kind of commercial activity that would support the need for the work, I guess similar to like an H-1B RFE, and they would ask for like evidence of the business activity, could be another case-specific thing. That recruitment report, that's pretty important. Can you expand on the recruitment report and what it is and how that is relevant or important to a perm audit?
Yeah, so the recruitment report details the testing of the labor market, and that's to ensure that, you know, no qualified U.S. workers were available for the position. The DOL requires that the employer to provide all of the resumes of the applicants, along with a report outlining how each applicant was contacted and why they were not selected for the position. So that recruitment report is really just making sure, again, that no US qualified workers were available for that position.
Right. So you can't, as a company trying to sponsor a foreign national for a green card case, you can't just make a blanket statement like, oh, we couldn't find anybody qualified to do the job. You have to methodically prove that, right? So, like, if you get 10 resumes, you have to have 10 articulable reasons why each person was disqualified for the position. And, you know, we help our clients with this, but there's, you could be disqualified on the face of the resume in a lot of cases, like job requires a master's degree and this per the applicant has a high school diploma that can be disqualified on the face of the resume. But then there are other cases that could only be disqualified after an interview where somebody is, you know, qualified on the face of the resume. That person needs to be interviewed and asked questions about the job duties to determine if they have the knowledge and ability to perform the job. And sometimes, like, if an employer just disqualifies them on the base on the face of the resume, even if they're facially qualified, you might be able to do that in the real world with, you know, trying to find somebody to qualified for the job that has nothing to do with immigration. But in the perm, you know, Department of Labor certification world, you need to confirm whether that person is minimally qualified, not a preferred candidate. So I think that's where, like, an example where people can kind of get hung up. And the perm audit would be the place to discover that. You know, you'd see, oh, this person has a master's degree in computer science, and it says here they were never contacted for an interview, or you know, you only reached out once to and to, for an interview, and that one little piece could be enough to dismantle the entire case and say that it was you know, that it would be denied, and you have to start over all over again. So dotting the I's and crossing the T's and making sure everything was done correctly. I've seen situations where, you know, the newspaper accidentally places it in the Saturday instead of the Sunday,
Right.
and they disqualify on that basis because it wasn't in the Sunday paper like the re regulation says. So it can be pretty draconian. Can you tell me, Maggie, a little bit about you know, I know we often talk to our clients about, like, who's supposed to be paying for what. Department of Labor has its rules and USCIS has its rules. Can you talk about, like, the expenses associated with the perm case and, you know, what's required there from the employer and the employee?
Right, so the DOL is actually going to request declarations from both the employer and employee confirming that the employer has paid all of the perm-related costs. So it's the employer that has to pay those perm-related costs. And that includes the legal fees, and the advertising costs. So this is to ensure that there was no real wage deductions or kickbacks or indirect payments involved. With the employee actually having to pay for those perm-related costs, because
Yeah.
they don't have to pay, the prevailing wage. So,
Right. And we've seen that where, you know, let's say the prevailing wage, or, you know, the required wage is $90,000 and the applicant is being paid $100,000, but then they tell them, oh, well, you know, you're going to have to reimburse us $5,000 for the, you know, for the perm case. That's still a violation. In DOL would say that the required wage there is 100,000, not 90,000, because the offered wage is 100,000, and by taking 5,000 from them, you're for the green card case, you're only paying, quote unquote, only paying 95,000, which is 5 less than the required wage. So no matter what amount you're paying, you know, you could be paying $200,000 and take 5,000. It's like, okay, well, you've deducted the required wage by 5,000. So yeah, you can't seek reimbursement. You know, not just on the front end with paying, but even on the back end reimbursement from the employee, because that is still going to create a back wage liability there. Maggie, I want to talk. We've talked about the audits generally speaking. Can we talk about, like, so I think the main type of audit that we often see, especially when their frequency has increased, which, you know, happens from time to time over the years, is this thing called a business necessity audit. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, so business necessity refers to the employer's need to justify the qualifications for a position, and that's especially for professional roles. So If the employer's job requirements exceed what is typically required for that position, they have to demonstrate that these requirements are essential for the job and reasonable within the context of the employer's business. So if if you deviate from what is typically required, you have to have a reason for it.
Okay. Yeah, and I think in practice sometimes what we often see is if a company has very high minimum requirements, the DOL would say, well, like, what's the business necessity for having requirements this high? Because sometimes I think what DOL like thinks is like, well, look, you don't really, these aren't the minimum requirements. These are just what you're foreign national applicant ha seems to possess, and you are trying to weed out otherwise qualified U.S. workers for the position. So are these really the minimum requirements, or are these the preferred requirements? So just like in the real world, again, when employers are looking for employees, no one is really looking for the most minimally qualified person. It's like it's no such thing.
Right.
You're looking for like the best person for the job. So in the real world, in the real market, you're like, who do I prefer to do the job? This person has 10 years of experience, whereas this person has 5. I prefer this 10-year, applicant maybe. And DOL is not about the real world. Perm is not about the real world. In this exercise, what you're looking for is how much education and experience do you need to be minimally competent in this job? And that's often a conversation we have with the employer. Like, wait a minute, you're saying this job requires a master's and 10 years of experience, and the foreign national has a master's and 10 years of experience. Is this what you prefer? Or is this the base? Like, master's and 9 years of experience is not competent enough to do this job. Is that what you're saying? So often that's like a conversation we have at the front end to make sure, we're establishing minimum criteria, not preferred things. And but even if it's still, high, DOL can come back and say, what's up with this? And you can show things like prior hiring practices, that this is a consistent minimum requirement. Maybe also some stuff about the work that they'll be doing to show that it's sophisticated enough to require whatever level of education and experience. So those are some things that could be used to address a business necessity audit.
Kevin, what are some things that can cause a perm labor certification after an audit to be denied? We've talked a lot about what employers need to do in order to comply with the regulations surrounding perms, but what can cause a perm to actually be denied after an audit?
In a word, technicalities. This practice of our practice of law for us is almost not a practice of law. It's just data entry and technical things. Over the years, we've seen cases, not in our in not necessarily at our office, but just seen cases that DOL has addressed where people accidentally put the wrong data in the perm application. The prevailing wage is 90,989, but you wrote 90,898. Even though the prevailing wage says the right information, you type the data wrong into the perm, denied. Or the Saturday Sunday example. So this part of a person's green card journey is hyper technical and very minimally has to do with like law and legal practice and legal definitions and things. That stuff comes later on when you first start dealing with USCIS, when you file I-140. But the perm and the deal and recruitment, it's all a hyper technical process. So like when we see denials, it's almost like they sift through and see, oh, here's one little piece of, yeah, policy wise, they did test the labor market and they, tried, but they said Saturday instead of Sunday. So now I can deny this case. That's so we're just looking for technicalities, I feel like, for the most part.
Right. Okay. And then, do you have any specific examples where a perm was denied, or are there any commonalities that they seek out when they do these perm audits?
Well, I mean, shameless plug here, but we have a over 95% approval rating, so we try to, address these issues at the front end, make sure that the company is listing actual minimum requirements and not preferred things. And, we have a rigorous system for the data entry part to make sure that all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. Sometimes some controversial things come up. Like, so one thing that I can think of is the use of on the job, excuse me, on the job training. So sometimes a person, a foreign national applicant wants to use experience they gained on the job with the sponsoring employer to qualify for the position. So, like for example, let's say someone has 3 years of experience before they join the green card sponsoring employer. They work for the green card sponsoring employer for an additional 3 years, and they have a bachelor's degree. And now they want to do an EB2 case, which requires a bachelor's and 5 years of progressive experience. And in this case, they have 3 years of experience working for a different employer, but the other, 2 years required for the job would only be gained was gained on the job with the sponsoring employer. And the rule is you can't use on the job experience to qualify for the position unless the work experience is substantially different from the job that you're being sponsored for. So sometimes people are like, need to use that on the job experience, and then we have to th then it becomes a kind of a subjective analysis of whether this old work experience is different enough than the new job to qualify for the experience requirement. So sometimes there's some controversial or potential red flag things like that that comes up. But for the most part, I think what we see are the data entry kind of technicalities is probably the most common reason for denial.
Gotcha. Okay, well then, lastly, how can employers actually prepare for a successful perm process? Just so that, if an audit does come around, they're ready for it.
Yeah, so the compliance file that you need to keep showing that you followed all of these rules is an end product of a lot of other hoops to jump through. There are a lot of things in immigration that can be done by yourselves or, with minimal support from an attorney. The perm process is not one of those things, not the way it's set up right now. You have to submit it online. You have the time requirements, like you have to get this prevailing wage determination. There's a window of time where that's usable. You have to place ads in a specific kind of way, and those ads are only valid for a relatively short window of time. And you invest all this time, money, and effort in this process that it's about a 2 year process. And if that whole 2 year process is wasted because Saturday was listed instead of Sunday, or this number was inverted, or something like that, it would just be such a waste. So if there was going to be any investment in legal representation at any stage, and you can only pick one stage to do it, I would say the first stage of labor certification would be the place to do that. So whether you are doing this for the 10th time, the first time, the 1,000th time, not only do these rules sometimes change about how to submit the perm, but more frequently the policies change, and we're getting ready into get into another policy shift with the new incoming administration. And having a sense of those changes early on might be the difference between wasting thousands of dollars in time, money, and effort, and saving it.
Right, exactly. So, even if you hadn't used an attorney at the, beginning stages of it, it might be worthwhile given this administration change to, consult with an experienced legal attorney or legal counsel to see what can be avoided. Maybe anything can be fixed. Just to make sure that you're prepared for a possible audit down the line.
Absolutely. And so that was, thank you, Maggie, so much for that discussion. If you guys have any questions about perm audits, feel free to reach out to us. Until next time, thank you.
Thanks.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Murthy Law Firm. Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.